Okay, welcome all to the, what are we at here, May 17th Q&A session. If there's any new people with us tonight, glad to have you join us. If you would like to become a member, there is a link in the chat on where you can go to join the group. Right now I'm going to mute all. You will have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so if you want to make a question or comment, and please remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. Tonight's deck, along with the audio recording and the contents of the chat window, will go up on our website probably sometime later on this evening. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Thanks, Chris. And we're going to start off this week with some public service announcements. And so first off, if you missed the early chat there, our pizza queue this year will be on June the 14th, and this year it's going to be at Britannia Park, and we have the trolley picnic station all booked for that. However, we have something new this year. If you want to find pizza on the table and drinks in the cooler, you will need to register. So send Jocelyn an email to pizzaparty@opcug.ca. And tell him if you and or a guest are going to attend the pizza queue. And for those of you who don't know, we used to have barbecues, real barbecues, where members would haul in barbecues from their backyard deck and actually cook up hamburgers. But then a few years later, we switched over to pizza. So but we kept the name pizza queue. So that's why it's called pizza queue. Anyway, you have to register, so don't forget to send in an email ahead of June 14th. Okay, next item. We have developed a question and answer poster. It's basically meant to promote these sessions that we're having right now. So if you know of somewhere where we could actually use this, so for example, if you'd like to print a copy and post it in a grocery store or a computer shop that you do business with, or if you know an organization that has a website where you could upload the PDF version of the poster, and the poster is available on the website at that URL right there. So if you have any ideas how we can better promote the club and the Q&A sessions in particular using this 8.5x11 poster, let us know. Okay, and next up we have a couple of things from Chris.
Yeah, so first off is we do have a vacancy on the board of directors. We have a 9-member board. We currently have 8 board members, so we're looking to appoint a 9th. And the main position we're looking to fill is the program chair. So if you have any bent towards that, by all means, get in touch with us. We also, we're currently splitting up duties of public relations amongst multiple board members. So if there's anybody who's interested in taking care of public relations, that would be welcome as well. So if you're interested in any of that sort of stuff, talk to any current board member. We could have you come out to a board meeting. You can see how we operate before you decide to commit yourself to it or anything like that. But we would encourage participation.
And you can certainly use the suggestion box email address for that, or the email for all the directors are on the masthead page at the back of every newsletter. Okay, next up, Chris.
Yeah, so we've been doing Q&A weekly over Zoom, all except for main meeting nights. And tonight we're passing 1,000 topics that we'll have covered. We should, if we cover all our topics tonight, it'll be 1,002 topics that we've covered. There we go. And probably within another 2 weeks, we will pass 5,000 participants. And on July 26th, we should be hosting our 150th Q&A over Zoom, which they first started when we went into lockdown because of COVID. So be a part of it. Be a part of the well, you're here tonight, so you're here when we pass the 1,000 topics. If you're here a couple of weeks from now, you'll be part of the passing of 5,000 participants. And if you're here on July 26th, you'll be part of our 150th Q&A over Zoom.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Yeah, sorry about that. This mouse wheel seems to be incredibly sensitive, and I just brush it and it switches the slides on me. Okay, the next item I have is kind of a follow-up on ChatGPT, and in particular, a presentation I gave at Members Favorites last week. And I pointed out that ChatGPT, as well as writing code, it will actually optimize code for you, and in particular, it will optimize Excel macros, and I showed some things that it suggested. So one of the things it said was that do while loops are slower than for next loops. So Chris suggested it would be neat to check it out. So I didn't want to go through that 14,000 record file, so I picked a file that only has just under 4,000 records, and I ran this macro against the 3,705 records using a dual while loop. And you can see there that I set the time at the start, and then I had it set the time at the end, and it took 54 seconds to chew through those 3,700 records. So I basically replaced that do while loop with a for next loop and ran the same macro, and it took 54 seconds. And so my optimized code doesn't really run any faster, if at all. Certainly not to the nearest second, it doesn't. And the other thing it said was you could turn off manual calculations. So I tried doing that with this for next loop. I set application calculation equals X1 manual, and it took 54 seconds. So whatever I do to optimize this code, it takes 54 seconds. So Excel is really efficient at whatever it does, or optimization techniques don't work very well. I don't know. Anyway, there you go. If you're an Excel user, you can play with those techniques to your heart's content, and I hope you fare better than I did. Not this big deal to change a couple of lines of code. Okay, next item is a share which popped up on a YouTube video that I saw. And the genesis was a tweet from the FBI, the Denver Bureau of the FBI. And they were basically warning people that free charging stations for USB devices in things like airports and hotels and so forth, nasty people have figured out ways to load malware onto your device if you do that. So they're suggesting basically carrying your own charger and use an electrical outlet instead. Well, the video is actually from Gary Sims of Gary Explains fame, and he basically posits that maybe the FBI Denver office is somewhat overstating the risk. This idea of compromised USB charging ports has been around for more than a decade. However, he says, should you be careful? Well, always you should be careful. But he believes this whole exercise is a storm in a teacup. However, if you want to avoid any problems, then the American Federal Communications Commission, FCC, has some advice. And it's basically similar to the stuff that the FBI were saying. If you use just a regular power outlet, then there won't be a problem. Use your own charger, either in an outlet or a car charger, and your own USB cable. An external battery pack is another way to charge up your phone if you have such a deal, and if it's also charged. And one of the interesting things is consider carrying a charge-only cable, which basically only has the power lines and prevents the data from being transmitted to your smartphone or tablet. And then finally, if you plug it into a USB port at one of these locations, now a lot of them are updated. So they ask you, do you want to share data? Do you want to trust this computer? Do you want to charge only? clearly you don't want to share data, you don't really want to trust it. Charge only is the option if you're given that option. Now, interestingly enough, I'd seen something on this previously because Bill Van Dyke had an item on the members only forum, and he was talking about USB charging cables, and he pointed out that USB cable has essentially four wires. There's two power wires, 5-volt positive and ground, and there are two data lines. So any data, including malware, that's going to be transferred to your phone has got to come over the two data wires. So he pointed out you can buy charge-only cables, which are safe for public charging stations because they only have the two power wires, and so they can't transmit any data. So I looked up these guys on the internet, and it struck me they're actually quite expensive. These are the cheapest ones I could find. And they're both on Amazon, and they're both from StarTech. One is an actual cable. It's a secure charging USB cable. And the other one is kind of an adapter, a secure charging USB data blocker adapter. But obviously, it's the same idea. They've only got the power lines. They don't have the data lines. So then I thought, well, how would you actually go about making one of these? Maybe you could take a cable and rip out the two data leads. And it turned out, of course, there's always a YouTube video somewhere or a website that'll tell you how to do it. And this guy basically suggested putting tape over the two data contacts. And that would essentially provide insulation, so you wouldn't have electrical connection to those data lines, and so you'd only have the power positive and negative connections on your USB cable. So those are some options if you use these public charging stations, and something to think about. Okay, moving along, we have a share from Stuart on his Loony Bits series.
You have to unmute yourself there, Stu. There we go.
There's the button. Okay. Loony Bits, what do we got this week? We have all kinds of little items about services in Canada. Is there a slide, Alan?
Right there.
Oh, yes. General consumer information. Whilst hunting for something, goodness knows what, and if I did, I wouldn't repeat it here, I came across this site, consumer.ca. That's always a good sign, .ca. Means they're trying to pretend to be Canadian anyway. And this is something that started in 2018 by I'll call him a young fellow because I guess I am getting older. And it's basically products and services in Canada in Canadian prices for Canadians. And there's the usual, right off the bat, we talk about cell phone services because that's everybody's biggest gripe these days, if not healthcare. But he goes into that too. He essentially lists a number of different services that the average person is going to be looking in for information for, and in Canadian dollars available in Canada. Things about your auto, home, money in general, lifestyle and entertainment and general life in Canada if you're considering moving here. He seems to have a one or two man show going, and did a lot of work during the lockdown, so I don't know how much effort's going to be put into maintaining this website, but there is a fair bit of information on Starlink and why cell phone prices are so expensive here, and open class action lawsuit settlements in Canada. That's always good. The best honey brands in Canada. I don't know. There's a lot of information here that could be of interest to people. And he seems to be maintaining it. So cansumer.ca, you might find it interesting. What else have we got? Oh, yes. I came across a YouTube channel. Brandon Beavis Investing. This is a father and son team that they run a business educating people about investments, investing, and the laws pertaining to such in Canada. They have some interesting stuff, and they have some really dry, boring stuff that I won't even touch. It's, you know, you pick your flavor. I found some interesting things about income tax a couple months ago, go figure. But they also try to teach people about investing in the stock market. They talk about cryptocurrency. They have, they try to keep people up to date on changes to the tax laws too. When things are coming, they try to let you know. I noticed today they have a new video out, how to set up RRSPs for a child. I haven't looked at it yet, so I can't say if that one's any good or not. But they focus on it from a Canadian perspective for Canadians. So if you're ever curious about financial information, there's a whole pile of videos on YouTube in their channel. And it's worth checking out. It goes back a few years. And we have one more bit. Another YouTube channel called The Breach. And I haven't seen too many of these yet, but it appears to be in the style of the Juice media. And if anyone's familiar with the Juice from Australia, they really dig their teeth into government incompetence and they don't let go. You know, they grab by the neck and they grab by the short hairs and they dig in and just tear people apart. So it's quite entertaining. Quite entertaining. The Breach isn't quite that vicious. You know, we are Canadians and we're polite. We just point out that people are making mistakes. Tut, tut, tut. But they are taking action on issues that they believe people should be aware of. And I recommend that if you're interested in what's going on in the world around you that affects you as a Canadian, it can't hurt to take a look at this. And I think I'm all bitted out for this evening.
Okay, thanks, Stuart. Very much, Stuart.
That's about as loony as I can get tonight.
We are still looking for other people to contribute to Loony Bits as well. So if you have any known good sources of information from a Canadian perspective, we'd love to put it into Loony Bits in the future.
Okay. Our next item is about LibreOffice Writer. And this came about from a question that Micheline asked on the Members Only Forum, where she wanted to change the default font in Writer. And this has always been a bugbear of mine, but I've never actually bothered to really look into it. But this time I did. I went and checked and found this this question and answer session in LibreOffice, the help forum. And they basically give the commands or the navigation path to actually make this change. So basically, when you open up when you open up a new document in LibreOffice Writer, by default, the default font is 12-point Liberation Sans, which is a sans serif font. Now, personally, I don't like that. A horror story, as far as Chris is concerned, I actually write everything in Times Roman. Chris hates Times Roman. Well, never
no,
mind that.
No.
We don't use Times Roman for this.
Used appropriately, it is fine.
I hate Times Roman.
Okay, anyway, by default, Writer gives you Liberation Sans. So basically, the website told me what I should do is go to Tools and Options, pick up the LibreOffice Writer tab, and then non-intuitively go for Basic Fonts Bracket Western. So when you open up that dialog box, the options, you scroll down, LibreOffice, Basic Fonts Western right here, and you get all these things that you can change, the default font, heading, list, caption, etc. So all I did was use this drop-down arrow here and select Times Roman instead of Liberation Sans, closed Office, and next time I open up Microsoft Office, by default, I'm now running Times Roman 12 point as I love and desire. However, it's worthwhile noting that you can change lots of settings in LibreOffice itself, in Writer, in Calc somewhere, LibreOffice Base, and there are dozens of different things you can change. And you know, it's one of these things, there are so many things I don't know where to start looking. So whenever I want to do anything, I always do a Google search and it will tell me where to go to change things. But some of the ones I do use, I set the storage path. So I set the storage path by default in my data drive, because that's where all my data files live. And I also set the spelling and grammar. It does inline spelling, but personally, I turn off the grammar checker. So those are just a couple of things that are in there. There's lots more. If you use LibreOffice, I encourage you to dig into the settings and see what works for you. It's very customizable. It's a really good program. Okay, moving along. Chris has a computer basics item.
Yeah, this started out as an extreme basic item. I had one tip that I thought, well, is this too basic for computer basics? And I asked Alan, and hope I'm not calling him out of turn here, but he said, well, I didn't know about it, so sure, it's good. And so I decided to expand on it a little bit. So the scenario behind this is when you're reading long articles at web pages, sometimes they can be long, really, really long. And you have many screens of information that you have to scroll through somehow to read all of the contents that is available on that particular page. And there's quite a few ways to accomplish this. So you can use your mouse, you can use a touch screen, or you can use a keyboard. Next.
And Tom notes you can use a touch pad as well.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay. If we look at using the scroll bar, which is that bar that goes down on the right-hand side of a page when there's more than one screen worth of information, and use your mouse. If you click the triangle at the top, it'll scroll the page up one line. Next. If you click the space between the triangle and the scroll bar, you'll scroll up one screen. You can click and drag the scroll bar to actually move it any arbitrary amount that you want. You can click between the bottom triangle and the scroll bar, or scroll button, I should say, to scroll down one screen. And then finally, you can click the triangle at the bottom to scroll down by one line. So that's one way of doing it. It works. I find that target is a little bit on the small side that you have to sort of hunt for, but it does work. Next. So you can also use the mouse anywhere on the web page, and you can do that by using the scroll wheel on the mouse. And if you just roll the wheel, you'll scroll up and down. Usually it'll be multiple lines at a time, but you can set it from anywhere from one line to 100 lines at a time, or you can set it so that as you scroll the wheel, it'll do one screen at a time. Next. So the way you set that up is in Windows 10, you go to Settings, Devices, Mouse. In Windows 11, you go to Settings, Bluetooth and Devices, Mouse. And then once you get to that, next, you'll see a section down there on scrolling. And the first option says roll the mouse wheel to scroll, and you can have the option of either multiple lines at a time or one screen at a time. Next. If you choose multiple lines at a time, then you can choose the number of lines to scroll at a time, and you can do it anywhere from one line to 100 lines that you want to scroll each click of the mouse wheel. Next. Then this is a repeat of a share that I had a couple of weeks ago, but I just put it in again here to sort of complete the picture when you're scrolling through web pages. So you can do continuous smooth scrolling. You place the mouse cursor anywhere on the page. I suggest start near the middle, and it'll become clearer why you want to be near the middle in a second. And then next, you click the mouse wheel. So you just press down on it. And the cursor will actually change to that where you have a dot and then you have a triangle above it and below it. Next. And then if you move the mouse pointer higher on the page, and this is why you want to start somewhere in the middle, if you move the mouse pointer higher on the page, you'll start scrolling smoothly up. Next. If you move it lower on the page, it'll start smoothly scrolling downwards on the page. Next. And then faster scrolling by moving further away from your starting point. And again, that is why it's a good idea. Start somewhere near the middle of the page, and then you have more control over how much faster or slower you scroll either up or down. And finally on this page, next, if you want to stop that smooth scrolling, you just press the escape key and the mouse will go back to its normal operations. Next thing you do is on a touch screen. So you can just touch the screen and drag up or down on the page. And you can also flick it up or down to move more than one screen's worth. If you flick it really slowly, you'll get less than a screen's worth. But if you flick it quickly, you'll actually have it scroll more than a page at a time. And it just scrolls, and then it'll slowly slow down and then stop. Next. And then you have your keyboard. So you can use your page up and page down keys to move up and down by one screen. You could use the arrow up or down keys to move up or down by one line. And then this was the thing that actually started off this thing. I thought, is this an interesting thing to put in as a computer basics? Is that you can actually use your space bar. And I find this to be the easiest one because it's a big target for my hand to hit. And it just, you hit the space bar, it'll scroll down one screen. If you want to scroll up, you can hold down the shift and hit the space bar, and it'll scroll up by one screen. Now, after having done all of this, I all of a sudden realized there was another way that came about with Bob Hares talked about voice dictation. So if you turn on voice dictation, you can actually do things like just say page up, scroll up, page down, things like that to move through your document. So if you like to use voice to control your computer, you can do it to control as you scroll through web pages. So that's pretty much, I think, the vast majority of the ways that you can end up scrolling through a web page with lots and lots of details where you just want to continuously go through the document on the web.
Okay, thanks, Chris. I wasn't on my own. Elizabeth at some point said, hey, I didn't know that.
Oh, there we go.
And Tom says he likes using the cursor keys because it's smooth and it gives you a smaller scroll. And yep. If you hold, then it repeats.
Yep. Yeah. But I guess the point is, like, Microsoft in their infinite wisdom is it gives you so many ways to do so many things. And so that's kind of neat, you know, that whatever works for you out of all of this, that's great. You know, so just pick the ways that work best for you and go for it.
Yeah, personally, I always use the that scroll bar on the right-hand side. And one of the problems there is sometimes it's quite narrow. Yeah. But in a lot of programs, you can actually customize the width of that. So that's something to look for if that's an issue for you.
Yeah. I could do a computer basic sometime on, like, Microsoft decided quite a while ago in Windows 10 to auto-hide the scroll bar, and it only appears if you mouse over top of it. And so I should do a computer basic sometime on how to turn that off, because I personally hate auto-hiding of scroll bars.
Yeah, me too. Okay, next up, I have another item on artificial intelligence, and this one comes from Chris Barnett, who's a UK computer scientist and runs the Explaining Computers YouTube channel and website. And his topic this week was, should we fear artificial intelligence? And it was kind of an interesting video. They're always fairly short, 20 minutes or so, but usually packed with some good information if the topic appeals to you. So this one basically related to an open letter that was published in March this year. Pause giant AI experiments, an open letter. And it was a lot of different people signed it, including some big names like Elon Musk and Steve Wozniak of Apple fame. And they basically, as it says, pause AI experiments. So they had a number of policy recommendations, which included things like auditing AI systems, and creating standards and creating regulations, which, as Chris Barnett pointed out, sound good in practice, but good in principle, but probably quite difficult in practice because different countries probably will not adopt those things. He also points out that AI has been around for a long time, and he says the first artificial intelligence programming was to have a computer play chess, and that was back in 1950. And in recent years, the big players, IBM, Amazon, Google, and several others, have all introduced AI services that you can access in the cloud. So it's a kind of a no mess, no fuss type option for people who want to have access to artificial intelligence tools. And then, of course, most recently, the big media ticket was ChatGPT in the fall of 2022. And that is now at version 4, ChatGPT 4. So he's asking the question, is it incredibly useful or is it exceedingly scary? And I think it's one man's position and opinions, but I think it's quite interesting to listen to what he has to say. And I thought his wrap-up was really interesting. He said, well, we should just ask ChatGPT itself. So he typed in, should we fear AI? And ChatGPT replied, oh, it's just simply a tool that can be used for good or bad purposes, just like any other technology. So the URL is on the previous slide. If you're interested in looking at that, it's Explaining Computers on YouTube.
And Tom has a comment in the chat. Why the big pause? Because AI is a bear. Good one, Tom.
Okay, I think the next one is Stuart's again. You have to unmute yourself again, Stuart.
Hello, I'm back. So, what am I back for? Ready Cloud. Yes. I have a a Netgear NAS that I've had for probably 10 years, and it's had its issues, but it's worked just fine. And I've been pretty much pleased with it for the cost and all. The support has been consistent and steady, and I was trying to get its app set up on my new phone, and I noticed a little message scroll across the top, and phone's got a small screen, so a little message on a little screen. I'm saying, what the heck? What? And it turned out that Netgear is going to discontinue remote access from the cloud for its NASes. I'm telling you, it's been working so good. For a couple of years, I had a login issue, and I developed some workarounds, and I kept it going. And a couple months ago, the problem disappeared, and I kept one workaround as insurance just in case. But I could log in and do exactly what I wanted, where I wanted, when I wanted. And then the buggers discontinued remote management and access. Oh! So Netgear is pulling out of the NAS game because it's not earning them enough money by the look of it. The slide here tells you when. I'm too heartbroken to read it any further. Seriously though, it's if anybody has a lot of information on a home NAS, the only, and it's made by Netgear, the only way you're going to be able to get at it is if you're on your home network. So Netgear is advising people to move anything they need to access when they're away from home or their home network to move it to Google Drive.
Apparently, yeah. There is a possibility. I put a link in the chat suggesting Zero Tier as a Ready Cloud replacement. Apparently, you can install it with an SSH command using a curl.
Well, these are early days, and there's going to be lots of suggestions, but this is the situation from the manufacturer at the moment. Thanks, Tom. I'll keep an eye on that.
And anyway. Harvey has pasted in the recommendation on using Synology NAS. I know a lot of people that do use Synology and are quite happy with it.
Yes, in fact, in the Netgear community forums, there was a lot of buzz about moving to a different NAS. But
it's a shame when something is working fine and all of a sudden it stops.
In my case, it's not going to affect me too adversely because anything I access remotely is a pretty darn, is a pretty darn small file. Usually something like the list of what's in my freezer so I can check when I'm in the grocery store to see if I should buy this chicken or not because I can't remember how much chicken I have. So I keep a spreadsheet of that. But nothing massive. And all this stuff that I access, I actually do have it backed up on Google Drive or anyway. But if you're someone who is using this for work or you're professionally on your own, and maybe you're looking at massive files of whatever sort, you're going to be looking at a new NAS or a workaround of some sort.
Presumably, Stuart, the hardware is fine. It sounds like it's the software that drives it is being changed.
Yeah.
No, I what I've read indicates that Netgear is just not making enough money from supporting these things that are working fine, and they're not selling more of them. As I said, my NAS is 10 years old and I'm still getting security updates for it every day. That stuff is just fine, but the cloud support for accessing it requires servers of some sort. I don't know what the heck it requires. I'm not a software engineer.
Check the chat.
It requires money and they don't want to spend it.
Check the chat, though, because Tristan's pointing out another option called tailscale.com, which he says will access and back up your home network remotely. So it sounds like, you know, there are software solutions out there which will avoid the problem with the Netgear stuff.
I've heard of Tailscale. That sounds more like a security solution for accessing securely your home network. But anyway.
Okay. Well, we hear your pain, Stuart. And Stuart and Chris is going to make
half of it.
Chris is going to make more of it right now, I think.
Yeah, this led into me doing one of my rants on vendor support this time. So it's good to keep in mind the idea that All vendors will eventually drop support for the products and services that they make and market. And there is no standard out there for how long vendors have to support something that they sell you. They could decide that, you know, it's no longer supported tomorrow, or they might support it for 10 years. There's absolutely no standards out there. And things can change after you buy something. So even for existing products that you've bought, they may all of a sudden arbitrarily decide, well, we're no longer supporting it even though we said we would before. So just keep those sort of things in mind. Next. So I'm going to use Microsoft as an example, and it's not that they're necessarily the most egregious or the only one out there that has support policies that I seriously question or find confusing, but they are a good example of it. So originally back in 20 years ago, Microsoft never had stated end of support on any of their products. But then this changed around Windows XP, because it turned out that Windows XP was in use a whole lot longer than Microsoft actually hoped that it would be. And so they came out with a new policy, and they would support business products for 5 years of mainstream support. And that means any bug fixes, enhancements, anything like that at all, security problems, so forth, in the first 5 years. After that, they would get another 5 years of extended support, and that was mainly security updates. So they wouldn't change functionality and things like that, but they would keep security patches going for another 4 years. So you'd have, and that's, for me, that's the main thing with a product. After 5 years, presumably they fixed most of the bugs that are in the functionality end of things, and I'm then really concerned with security updates. And so that means that I would get 10 years of support from when it is first released. And that included all of their versions of Windows and Office. So they, that was on the business side of things. Consumer products, they just promised 5 years of support and no extended support. So that'd be more on the game side and things like that. Next. Then they came out with some later changes. And they came out with what they called their modern lifecycle policy, which was first introduced in October 2016. Next. And this is a quote from their website. So it covers products and services that are serviced and supported continuously. Under this policy, the product and services remains in support if the following criteria are met. And the first two I don't have real objection to, but the last one I do. So it says customers must stay current as per the servicing and system requirements published for the product or service. That can have a little bit of a getcha on there. So say that they have a particular product and then they say all of a sudden, oh, to continue using this version of the product, or, you know, our next iteration of it that is the same version number, so to speak, we're going to require you to have a higher level processor or double the memory or something like that. And all of a sudden, well, you're no longer supported if you don't meet those additional system requirements. So that could happen. Not real likely, but it could. Customers must be licensed to use product or service. Okay, that makes sense. But then the last one, Microsoft must currently offer support for the product or service. Now think about that for a second. The product or service is in support if Microsoft currently offers support for the product. That's a kind of curious way of getting out of anything by just saying, we don't offer support anymore, so therefore we don't have to provide support. So kind of weird. Anyway, next. My rants go on here. So what does this mean? So let's take Windows 10 as an example. So Windows 10 version 21H2, which came out November 16th, 2021, the end date for support is June 13th of 2023. So not very far off. 22H2, which is a free upgrade to Windows 10. I mean, you can get it. If you're on Windows 10, you can get Windows 22H2 as long as your hardware supports it. I don't know. Start date on that was October 18th, 2022, and the end date for it is October 14th, 2025. Next. So Windows 10, prior to 21H2, is already out of support. So if you're running an older version than 21H2, then Microsoft feels no obligation to provide you with any support, including security patches. So Windows 10, 21H1, was released May 18th, 2021, only 2 years ago. So it is now out of support after less than 2 years, or just 2 years as of tomorrow. So you know, as again, this is a free upgrade to 21H2 or 22H2, but there is a possibility that for some reason your particular computer can't take 21H2 or 22H2. Who knows? So you must be on a recent release of any given version to be in support. So the version I'm talking about here is the feature release, such as version 1809 or version 21H2 or anything like that. Keep in mind, releases are free. My apologies, my phone is. So releases are free. Microsoft does make it difficult for you to stay on old releases. They nag you a little bit, and then there's some talk of that they will try to just force people to upgrade to, you know, the 21H2 or 22H2 or whatever to remain in support. Next. So let's just be a little bit more confusing. So let's look at Microsoft Office. Microsoft Office 2019 follows the fixed lifecycle policy as opposed to the modern lifecycle policy. What does that mean? Next. Office used to be supported for, as I said earlier on, 5 years of mainstream support, 5 additional years for extended support, which is basically security patches. Next. So Microsoft Office 2019, which was released on September 24, 2018, the end of mainstream support was October 10, 2023, 5 years. But then the extended support was October 14th, 2025, only 2 additional years rather than 5 additional years. I actually had an argument with some people in the Microsoft MVP program about this, and I said, no, it says can't be ending on that. They have a policy of 5 years of extended support. They very quietly, just all of a sudden, when Microsoft 2019 came out, it's only 7 years that you get total of support. Next. So, we want to be a little bit more confusing. Microsoft Office 2021 follows the modern lifecycle policy. It was released on October 5th, 2021, and the end of all support is October 13th, 2026, and there is no extended support listed for that. Now, the Office 2021, that is the license where you, it's not a subscription, you just buy it and it is good for, you know, you don't have to fork over any other money to Microsoft after that. Next. But the modern lifecycle policy covers products and services, service and supported continuously. Next. The product remains in support as long as Microsoft offers support. So go back to that slide. You know, that they're saying we will support this as long as we support it. Okay. What does that really mean? I don't know. Maybe Microsoft is going to choose to no longer support Office after October 13, 2026. I have no idea. Who knows what they're going to do? Next. And if you're not confused enough, Microsoft Office or Microsoft 365, which used to be Office 365, follows the modern lifecycle policy. Its start date is September 22nd. Oh, that should be 2015, not 10/15. And there is no end support date listed on the Microsoft website. Next. And the reason why they don't actually list an end date is that it's a subscription service. Okay, so Microsoft 365, you pay for it by the year. And as long as you keep paying, Microsoft will keep, first off, forcing updates on you because you really have no choice. They will just push out updates to you. And they will keep supporting it, presumably until they change its version number to Microsoft, I don't know, 7.730 or something like that. I don't know. Next. And then again, I say, yeah, they'll keep supporting it until they change the support policy arbitrarily and not usually for your benefit. Next. Okay, so keep in mind that under the modern lifecycle policy, you have to be meeting their system requirements, which they can arbitrarily change at any time, and they will only support it for as long as they decide they want to support it. So next.
Just before you go on, Chris, yep. Tom says, for what it's worth, he's using Office 2007. And he says, help works if you turn off all web access via the firewall.
Yeah. Now, Office 2007, you can pretty much bet you're not going to get any security updates for it. Something to be worried about. And BS, what does it mean for Office 2016? It is already out of support.
I've also turned off any macros, which is, in general, a good idea in Microsoft, unless you explicitly need them.
Yeah, for sure. So next. Okay, so other vendors. Now, this is where Apple, I got to give them credit. I always talk about how if I touch an Apple product, my hands will probably burn. But Apple will support iPhones. For 7 years, not from when it was first released, but from the last time they actually sold that particular model. That's pretty decent. I don't know anybody who is supporting products for 7 years from the time they stopped actually selling it. That's pretty good. I got to give kudos to them for that. Samsung Galaxy devices, they now provide, and this is a quote from their website, they will provide up to 5 years of security updates. So in other words, they could stop tomorrow because that's up to 5 years. I don't know. The way they use these weasel words, I really got to give them credit because I think a lot of people have been reporting that Samsung Galaxy devices are supported for 5 years. Not according to Samsung. According to Samsung, it's up to 5 years. Linux Mint, even open source stuff, is only supported for a period of time typically. So Linux Mint is a good example. They support for 5 years on each release, and they say after that, you must upgrade to the next version or install a new version anew. Next.
But the versions come along more quickly than that generally.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's good to have it a long time. If people don't want to go through the pain of an upgrade or potential pain of an upgrade, or there's some other reason why they have to stick with a particular version that they can't go to a newer version. And there can be all kinds of reasons that are out there. And so it is nice to have long supported time frames for sure.
And your kudos to Apple is worth noting. Tom's put a link in the chat window, how long will my Android phone be supported with updates? Which would be probably well worth a read.
Yeah, it's all over the map for that because it comes down to the vendor as much as Android itself. And just talking about Android, and in this case, because that comes out of Google, and on our next slide, we'll talk about Chrome OS, which is also put out by Google. So Chrome OS is interesting because this is direct from Google's words itself. Every Chrome OS device receives regular updates from Google until it reaches the automated auto update expiration date, which is subject to support from the component manufacturers. So whatever device you have that is running Chrome OS, it is more subject to the support from the person who built the device than it is from Google itself. Now, interestingly, and I got to give them a lot of credit for this, they have a web page where they actually list devices from 54 different vendors that put out Chrome OS devices. And there's a total of 485 devices on that list, 209 from Acer alone, 7 devices from Google. So these are Google Pixel tablets and things like that, 18 from Samsung, and so it's really across the board all over the place. Now, I really have to give credit to Asus and Lenovo on this. They have these auto-update expiration dates that go out as far as June 2032. So there are two devices from Asus and three from Lenovo that are going to be providing support for, another 10 years. That's pretty incredible. Now, it would be interesting to see whether they really hold to that, but that certainly is their current outlook on it. Next. And my last slide on this rant So a bottom line on it, the vendors make the rules. Okay. There are wildly differing support policies and end dates, what exactly they'll support and for how long. And it's become apparent they can change their mind whenever they feel like it. And consumers have little, and I say, you know, read that as being no say in the matter. When you buy a device or a piece of software, you know, you might want to look and see, you know, what is the current support policy for that particular product? You know, you might be able to use a search engine to find out more info about it, or the vendor's site itself, although the vendor's sites are, they often seem to bury that information or make it very difficult to find or read. But information generally is out there. But no matter what you read, realize that it seems apparent that the vendor can change those policies anytime they feel like it. And can you sue them? Probably. Are you going to? Probably not. You know, so just realize that the sand can shift out from under you at any point in time at all. And that's all I have.
So following up on your note on Apple, Tom's put another link in about iPad support and says there are 9 years, of up to 9 years for security updates.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. It really is.
Okay, Chris, yeah, it's a real problem with some of these things. Android phones especially, some of them have really short lifetimes.
Yeah.
And it's really difficult to update it with third-party software using a custom ROM, for example. It's not an easy boy at all. By the same token, I think when Chromebooks go out of service, I think it's pretty simple to install Linux on those.
Ah, okay.
Okay, so I don't think I missed any questions in the chat, but if anybody has any other questions, we're in the last 5 or 6 minutes, I think. So there's something here from Marjorie. Anybody in the group available for hire as a tech tutor? Microsoft has locked me out of my email as I've gone grossly over my free storage limit. Although I've been deleting for days, I'm not sure I'm doing what I should. Alternatively, can anyone suggest an outside the group tutor? Anybody have any bright ideas on how to rectify that situation?
One thing I'll say on that, if you're just deleting it, make sure you actually delete it from the trash as well. Because if you're most email services, and if you are on Outlook.com or Simpatico or something like that, when you delete something, it just goes into the trash, and it'll stay there by default for, I think, 30 days before it gets deleted. So make sure you empty your trash. Otherwise, you're not really lowering your amount of storage that you're actually using.
And another thing you can do, you might be able to do, is to actually filter your mail. So if you can find a sender the way you don't want any of their mail, you can filter on that, select them all, and just delete them all at once.
Another thing would be good is if you can sort by size, you can maybe hit some of the big bang for the buck emails. What's the point of deleting, 100 1K emails if you can delete one email that has a 10 megabyte attachment in it or something like that? So if you aim to get the big bang for the buck stuff out of the way quickly, that'll get you back in operation quicker.
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
I underlined on the title and an underlined title, I highlighted, I changed the font to red for one word, and the underlining under that word that's underlined, that's highlighted in red, is red. It turns to red. It doesn't stay black. Is there a way to keep it black? By changing the font color of a word, the underline underneath turns to that color.
Okay, is it the last word on the line?
No, that is? No.
No, it's not the last word. Okay, because the most common thing I see on that is that if you pick up the paragraph marker at the end of the line and you turn it red, then it will carry on below it. But if it's not at the end of the line, it wouldn't be the case there.
What's the application we're talking about? Is it Word?
We're talking about Word. Simply,
If you go Control-Shift-N, that'll change the paragraph back to normal, which presumably will not have the red underlining.
Control-Shift-N
as in Nancy? Or no format, I guess, is what they...
No, it changes the font to another font, and it changes back to the black, and it removes the underline if I do that.
Yeah, and then try going in and again applying it to just that word?
Still red.
Wow, that's weird.
Yeah, maybe we'll have to take that one under advisement for a follow-up maybe next week.
Yeah.
If it's a red underline, you could try underlining that word or that paragraph, like with Control-U, and then Control-U again to remove the underlining. And if it removes all the underlining, then the red underlining should go too.
No, but it's a title. I want the underlining to be black all throughout and that word to be red.
Yeah, I see.
Another way to do it is not put any underlining and then just add a line.
But it's a title. I underline the title.
You should be able to for sure.
Would it make any difference if it was in a heading format rather than just a straight line with underlining? If there's a separate heading format for that font?
I think the problem is that the underlining takes on the color of
the
font.
Yeah, it takes on. That's so,
change that. But I think Alan's suggestion was the best. Just put a line underneath it.
Draw a line and make the line black and then have your font red.
So instead of underlining, just making the...
Yeah, you'll just have to be careful if you make any changes.
But the line goes all throughout the page if I do that.
No, not that kind of. Just draw a line. So you'd have to be careful because if you changed anything.
Oh well, no, I'm not going to do that in 300 chapters.
Okay.
Did we tell you about macros?
That's really funny because I've just been playing around on mine and I can't get it to do what you're saying at all. That's interesting. If it's not a huge document and it's not sensitive, if you could send a copy of your document to suggestionbox@opcug.ca, Alan and I could take a look at it and see if we can figure out what's going on.
I just did it in Word and I have the same problem. I mean, if you underline it and make it red, it's going to do both. It's going to do the font and the underline. I've never seen it where it keeps the black.
It's Word. Surely there's a way to do that.
I see what it is you're trying to do.
Yeah,
yes,
you're not
okay.
understanding what he's trying to do. So he's just underlining a title.
Yeah, okay,
of course,
gotcha.
The underline changes with the color of the font.
Yeah, okay, I got you now. Okay, so I don't think there's a way of doing that in Word. I think if you change the color of the word, the underline will take on that attribute as well.
Well, if you do insert an underline, for example, you press the minus key and let it repeat for a while, it'll offer to put in a line. And then you can select that line and then change the margins so it fits the title exactly.
Yeah, you'd have to fiddle, but you could do it that way. Yeah,
you've got
hundreds of pages with that. That's the problem.
Yeah, I can see that being not a useful way going about doing it if you have more than a couple to do. So, I'm thinking that is probably not doable with Word.
Oh, never say never.
Well, yeah.
I'll keep looking anyway. I just ran into this problem this week, so I'll keep looking.
Yeah, that's an interesting one for sure.
I do want that worded red, and I do want the underline in black.
Yeah. I understand now what it is you're looking for. I personally have never seen it that you could do that. But
yeah, you'd probably have to go into like a desktop publishing type software.
If you
end up not being able to do it, what I've been told by my desktop publishing friends and that is that underlining is very passe. So there you go.
I wonder if playing around in styles might end up with a solution that you could have it where as part of the style you have a line that's still going to be a problem of lining it up.
Well, that's why I was suggesting it may be a heading font, but yeah. I don't think it would work.
Yeah, I don't think that the styles is going to allow you to do that. But, interesting.
I keep looking.
Yeah, Alan will, I'm sure, look and see if LibreOffice Writer allows you to do that.
There you go.
Sure. Okay, so there's a question here from Bob Harris. He says,
thank you.
With respect to a Microsoft account, would it be possible to pay for a month and then download everything off that site?
What is it that you're trying to pay for? Like a Microsoft account is free. So it's not, you're not paying for an account. So you're paying for a service. What service is it that you're trying to pay for, Bob?
Extra storage.
Okay. Is it OneDrive? Bob?
No, I was thinking storage. I had the same problem on my Apple account. I bought a little more storage.
Oh, I see. This is a solution for
Marjorie.
Yeah, okay. So it would be a matter of buying additional storage space. But I think if you should be able to get down below your whatever it is that they give you for free. I think it's two gigabytes for free, I think, or something like that. If you have a Microsoft Office account, that gets you up to a terabyte. If you have a Microsoft 365 account, that gets you a terabyte of space. So that could be, if you want to maintain lots of space, that could be a relatively inexpensive way of getting additional space is to just buy a Microsoft 365 subscription. That'd be one option on there, I guess.
And you get your email back then, too.
Yeah, and I think that could be useful if Marjorie, if what you're looking for is to actually have keep as much email as you can, that would be the thing. Is buying additional storage for sure would be a solution for it.
Okay, I think we've covered everything that was in the chat window there. So,
yep.
Finalizing, I just want to go back to our pizza queue. That is our next monthly meeting, June the 14th. And again, I remind you, it's at Britannia Park this year. And if you're going, you need to register. So send an email to pizzaparty@opcud.ca. And then finally, our next meeting will be next Wednesday, May the 24th. So those of you who aren't on holiday, welcome to join us at night. And if you have any questions or topics that you'd like to share with the group, send those along to our suggestion box address. And apart from that, I hope everybody enjoyed tonight. We had a lively discussion in parts. So thanks everyone for attending, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, folks. See you next week, hopefully.